When my parents met my partner, Adam, for the first time, 15 years ago-ish, it happened to be the same day that his picture was on the cover of the Metro section of the Globe. The photo was of him being arrested. So there's an icebreaker for you. He was being arrested because he had been part of an eviction blockade. An eviction blockade is just what it might sound like. On the day that the sheriff shows up to forcibly remove someone from their home, volunteers physically block the door in protest. This blockade was led by an organization called City Life, Vida Urbana. It's focused on housing justice in Boston and surrounding areas. In the aftermath of the 2008 market crash, there were thousands of no-fault evictions around the city. I mean, countless around the country. But here locally, we were going through it, as banks were foreclosing on properties in default, and tenants had to get out. Their landlord's building was in default. They had to get out, even if they'd been keeping up faithfully with their rent payments. A disproportionate number of the predatory mortgages, which led to the bubble and crash, were dealt in working class neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color. So it was a disproportionate number of working class families and families of color who were losing their homes, either because their landlords had been the victims of predatory lending or because they themselves had been. City Life, which traces its origins to tenant organizers fighting neighborhood disinvestment in the 1970s, and which has kept up the fight for fair and affordable housing ever since, they responded to the 2000 era post-foreclosure eviction crisis in Boston's working class neighborhoods with its eviction defense campaign. Adam and I, being the energetic 20-somethings that we were, got wind of the eviction defense campaign and started going to the weekly public meetings at City Life to learn how we could help our neighbors stay in their homes. The meetings were intense. The majority of the people were there because they were in danger of losing their homes, and they didn't have much time to find a new place or much money to help with all the costs associated with losing your home. They were families with children. They were elderly people. They were just people, tired from work and all the stresses and indignities of being poor in our country. But the meetings were also hopeful because the people were getting organized. They were there to get resources, legal counsel, moral support, and when necessary, they were there to plan events like the eviction blockade that Adam was ultimately arrested at. An act of civil disobedience to send the message that housing is a human right, that tenants should be able to remain in their homes while the banks and the city work out longer-term solutions, solutions to keep people housed and keep communities whole. The title of my sermon today, Power Concedes Nothing Without a Demand, is from a speech by Frederick Douglass, given in 1857 on the 23rd anniversary of the emancipation of the enslaved black people of the West Indies. I confess that prior to preparing for this sermon, I had only ever heard the quote. I had never read the entire speech. But in places like City Life, Douglass's words, power concedes nothing without a demand, were offered as a kind of premise to what we were doing there. A rallying cry, a foundational principle, and it's always stuck with me. I appreciate the clarity of the sentiment, the rhetorical punch it packs. When people's rights are denied by law or by custom, it's the people who have to fight for those rights. We cannot always count on the beneficence of those who hold power to do the right thing. So when I finally read the entire 1857 speech that contains this quote I've cherished all these years, it was a sobering realization that Douglass is not just talking about making moral demands. He delivered this speech during the years leading up to the Civil War, with the Fugitive Slave Act on the books and more than 3 million people enslaved in our country. I felt a bit naive when it dawned on me that, of course, his context included armed resistance. So this quote, which has helped me understand social change movements for much of my adult life, is about moral and physical struggles for freedom. Right. Once I got past that moment of realization, I had a question. Why did I inherit Douglass's quote in a place like City Life? Where we were planning lots of things, protests, legislative advocacy, door knocking, even some nonviolent direct action like the eviction blockades, but where, and I just want to be really clear on this, we were not planning to take up arms. The answer, of course, is right there in the question. Nonviolent direct action. The youth of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, as well as the members of the Southern Christian Leadership Council, people like, of course, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, put themselves in harm's way over and over again while pledging to commit to total nonviolence. They did this to dramatize the injustices of American racism and change the course of human history. And it wasn't just the organizers, it was also everyday people who got trained in nonviolent direct action techniques and participated in voter registration drives, sit-ins, boycotts, massive marches. Though the philosophy and practice of nonviolent civil disobedience did not originate with the civil rights movement, it was the freedom fighters of the civil rights movement who trained and mobilized thousands in the use of this tactic. And so it was they who brought it to bear as a tool in the movement for social change in our country. And nonviolent direct action has been the means by which the people make demands of power in every successive generation of social change movements since the 1960s. Women's rights, disability justice, the gay liberation movement, AIDS activism, anti-globalization, and more recently, climate justice, the movement for Black lives, all of these have used the tactics of nonviolent civil disobedience to make their demands. And time and again, these movements have shown us that it is possible to change hearts and minds, and sometimes even change laws and power structures and culture with peaceful means. Dr. Martin Luther King, drawing on the experiences of the Montgomery bus boycott and his studies of Gandhi, formulated 6 principles of nonviolence. I'm not going to list all 6 for you, but I do want to lift up 2 of them because they help us understand how the call of nonviolence is still very much alive today and how nonviolence is connected to our faith as Unitarian Universalists. For instance, one of the principles is nonviolence seeks to win friendship and understanding. Dr. King elaborates by saying, the outcome of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The end result of nonviolence is redemption and reconciliation. This resonates with our 8th UU principle, our commitment to journeying together toward the wholeness that is the promise of our work to dismantle institutional and cultural oppression. Another principle is, nonviolence seeks to defeat injustice or evil, not people. Nonviolence recognizes, the principle explains, that evildoers are also victims. They are not evil people. Just as Universalism recognizes that all of us have the capacity for good, practitioners of nonviolence understand that the way to heal the world is by struggling against unjust systems, not by demonizing individual people. Because ultimately, we need all of us. We are all in this together. When I say that the civil rights movement influenced generations of social change makers. I don't just mean they inspired them, which certainly they did. I also mean the actual people who did the work went on to train the next generation of people in how to do the work. For instance, the original members of City Life, which was called at its founding the Jamaica Plain Tenants Action Group when it formed in 1973, the original members of this group were residents and activists coming out of the civil rights movement. If it hadn't been for the organizers with City Life, who learned from those who came before them, if it hadn't been for those organizers who went knocking on the doors of buildings listed in the public record as undergoing foreclosure, if it hadn't been for them, the tenants who were at risk of losing their homes, those people I met during those Tuesday night meetings, they certainly wouldn't have known one another. It was unlikely they would have known one another if it hadn't been for the people bringing them together to plan what to do, working on how to stay in their homes. Working, I would add, effectively. Over the course of their post-foreclosure eviction defense campaign, more than 800 City Life families won their homes back. Before getting involved at City Life, I had the vague notion that power only resides in institutions, like the government, the boardrooms of big corporations, the banks. I had never witnessed people power before. Whatever small part I may have played in eviction defense, knocking on a few doors, making some phone calls, adding my body to the numbers marching in the streets for housing justice, I was repaid a millionfold in the healing it offered me to understand a little bit better the safety and security that my race and class privilege offers me, and to understand that it is possible to learn the tools and tactics to harness people power, organizing through peaceful means for the good of us all. Across the generations, the people's resistance to violence, our insistence that a better world is possible, is holy. Generation after generation, we learn from those who have come before us, and we keep the struggle going. Let us remember this, not just on Martin Luther King Day, but every day. Amen, and may it be so.